This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We're back for part two of the discussion on the defense with our friend Bo Smolka of PressBox. Bo, how are you doing?
Very good, thank you.
Talked about a lot of things in that first show, a lot about the secondary, a lot about the new alignment, the settled nature, as you mentioned it, of the safeties now. No big plays in the last two games, no passes of 20-plus yards. They're looking very good. Doesn't even look in some ways like the opponents really want to test the Ravens secondary in the same way they had been doing it. The Ravens declining playoff chances, we talked about a little bit in terms of DVOA. The changes to the seven-man front and how those permeated through the inside linebacker core, the outside linebacker core, and the defensive line in terms of changes that were true this week. So show worth going back and taking a listen to if you haven't already. I know most of you have. Got a new feature coming up in this show. It'll just be very brief, I promise you, but I've got a trivia question for you. And if you got the answer to this trivia question, there's no prize involved other than I will recognize you on Twitter as being the first to get it correct. If you do. But here's the question. We talked about Chris Board and Trenton Simpson splitting time by series in the first episode. Well, in 1996, there was a linebacker who was a true goal line specialist for the Baltimore Ravens in their inaugural season. And he had four consecutive stops for no gain at the 1 yard line. Okay. And those came in the game against Denver and then three more in the game against St. Louis, the 37-31 home overtime win. I'd like the name of that linebacker, please. Hit us up in Twitter on this, and you'll be recognized as the person who knows the Ravens trivia the most for the day. Anyway, getting back into the second, let's talk a little pass rush if we can. Interesting because Board really stayed exclusively with a four-man rush in this game on 20 of 21 snaps.
Yeah, I always wonder how they're going to attack that. And part of it is you have to, I've never been defensive coordinator, but you start to wonder what are we giving up if we bring more versus what's the advantage of not bringing more? And quite frankly, you look at the Eagles play, they hardly ever brought more. Right. And it leaves more guys in the pass patterns and harder to run on. But again, we talked a little bit about this pass rush group in general and how guys like Ajabo are not haven't been what they hoped he would be. Isaac hasn't been what they hoped he would be. And so that, you know, they're part of it is who are you going to bring in from where? You know, Kyle Hamilton playing deep safety again, there's something else. They're not, he was also, you know, dangerous as a slot blitzer, and that's kind of off the table now as well.
So Bo brought up an important point there. So the Eagles don't rush more than four very often either. And particularly at the end of the game, they weren't looking to show any crazy blitzes when they thought they had the game won. But they were still 32 out of 39 four-man rushes, which means seven, they went to five. The Ravens only rushed four or five either, but only one out of 21 did they rush five, which is, to me, extremely – it's on the extreme end of things. I know what they're trying to do in a certain sense, that they're trying to funnel Hurts to try and keep him in the pocket and let Hurts hurt the Eagles by making some mistakes, some what are basically unforced errors. On the other hand, when you're having so much trouble getting home, as the Ravens were in this game, they were really punting pretty much on their pass rush when they rushed four.
Yeah, and you know, Hurts, I mean, he didn't make the mistakes they were hoping that he would make, or they didn't have the catastrophic problems, sudden change plays, as they call it, to give the Ravens a big chance. And that's, they needed a couple of those for sure, and they didn't get them.
Yeah, they had a very low variance offense, as I call it, a lot of medium distance plays, particularly in the run game. They did have a couple losses, but they had mostly, you know, a bunch of fives. Six is where we start the cutoff, where we write down the blocking for every play. So they had a lot of fives that just didn't quite make it. And then their pass plays, I mean, they had to put together several of them to get efficient drives, but that's exactly what they did. On their four scoring drives, they had most of their big plays on those four drives and put them together in order to drive the length of the field to get three touchdowns and a field goal.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, the benefit is the Ravens aren't giving up the big plays, or haven't the last two games. They haven't given up a 20-yard pass play after giving up. They were second, and they'd given up 50 over their first 11 games, second highest in the league, and they aren't giving that up. I do still think they are soft in the middle of the field in the 8 to 15-yard range. They just they're it's still a little bit of an underbelly for them, and it was there again. I thought the Eagles might hit it even more than they did. But, you know, the Ravens, in the big picture, they're not getting killed by the big play, and that's giving them a chance. And if the other team is able to extend a drive and mount a drive and get down the field, they can. We talked in the other show, the Ravens, though, were fairly good on third down for much of the game, and that makes a big difference. So the emphasis clearly on them has been don't give up the huge chunk plays, and it's one of the ways that their defense has really improved.
All right, let's talk a little bit about what the pass rush did in terms of individual types of opportunities. So people who haven't listened to this show often, ample time and space for me is something I can count out with the click method on your DVR. You can count out exactly to 3 seconds using the pause and fast forward buttons typically on most DVRs. To count out in increments of one, you have to click out to 90 to get the 90 frames, and you'll see exactly where the pass rush is at that point. Eight times, 38% of the time, they allowed ample time and space, a 3 second with the space still to step into that throw in what I call the throwing cone, which is mean there's not impeded in that direction of the intended receiver. They had 58 yards on those plays, 7.3 yards per play. By the way, about 8.5 would be my expectation for that. So that was about 10 yards short of standard on those plays. Going through quickly the rest of them, they had the ball out quick six times from Hurst. That's where he was more effective on those 60 yards, 10.0 yards per play. Six would be a normal standard. This is about 24 yards above expectation. Again, it's not chart-topping numbers, but that was 29% of the plays. And they only got pressure 33% of the time, which is not enough. To get seven pressures and allow eight ample time and spaces is not good. You typically, if you're defense, you want a relationship about 1.5 to 1 between pressures and ample time and spaces you allow. But there's seven pressure plays. The Eagles only got minus six net yards. So both sacks and four incomplete passes were in there, 31 yards below expectation. So when they did got pressure, it was very effective, just they didn't get nearly enough of it.
Yeah, and like you said, they didn't force Hurts into big mistakes, and that was one of the things that would have really been helpful. I know they got one. There was a batted down pass, I believe, it was on a third down play.
Yep.
But they, you know, there were no, they didn't get a hand on a ball in his hand, strip sack. There was nothing, you know, it was, Hurts was contained, but he managed the game in a way that team, it worked for that team.
That's absolutely true. If you don't force Hurts to make some unforced errors, it's not a good thing. He did underperform his opportunity set in this game by approximately 17 yards. Ravens only allowed 112 passing yards in this game, and Hurts had 129 expected yards in this game, as I would lay it out from the opportunity set that he had. Not an impressive game by any sense for the Philly passing attack, but on the other hand, he really did stay out of the big mistakes.
Well, that's what I said. I thought the defense, possession after possession, it just looked, the defense just time and again gave the Ravens a chance to win the game. That defense did enough for most of the game. I mean, but again, we've talked before, the special teams errors and inconsistencies on offense created by a really good Eagles defense just gave the defense no margin for error. They had to be even better. And that's, at some point, that gets really hard.
Right. It was very difficult. They rushed the passer 20 times with four men, 5.2 yards per play, both of their sacks. By the way, anytime you can sack the quarterback one time in 10 with a four-man pass rush, you're really getting the job done. 10% as a sack rate is outstanding, really, with any number of rushers, but to do it with four men is really outstanding. Both of those sacks, though, came as a result of Marlon Humphrey blitzes. And so let's go over this, because the big plays in the game, Marlon Humphrey blitzed for a pressure on second and six on the second drive of the game. He blitzed again on what became the S minus six on the third drive to close out the third drive of the game. I said something incorrect here, and I'm going to have to go back and retract it in just a moment. And the other sack came, it actually came on the first play of the second half and didn't have anything to do with Humphrey. It was just an S0 that was off the initial pressure from Washington.
Right.
Sorry, on the initial pressure from Matabike, Washington took him down. But then you mentioned another play, and that was rushing Stevens off the edge to, it's still a four-man rush. They dropped three to zone, so simulated pressure there, where Stevens got his hands up and tipped the football. That was, looked like it was going to probably be stopped short of the sticks, but it was still very nice play by Stevens coming on the blitz. So they made very effective use of slot corner blitzes in this game.
Yeah, and I haven't seen Stevens in the backfield much at all. But again, they're moving Stevens around a little more now. They have Tre'Davious White, too. And you mentioned those four cornerback looks that they'll put out there in a dime setup. I don't know if that was the situation on that specific play. But you do see Stevens playing inside a little more than he used to when they have Tre'Davious White on the field now, too.
Yeah, he's exclusively really on the inside, because White and Wiggins are exclusively on the outside. So they really get to try and get the bigger, more physical corners inside. And that was in fact a nickel snap. I'm very surprised by that, but it had to be something with a tight alignment that they felt, you know, careful enough getting Stevens in there, or felt, you know, like they had a chance to get Stevens in there. Anyway, good play there. They only had one snap of five rushing with a 9 yards per play. There's nothing we'd learn from that kind of a sample size, but it's just kind of interesting that Orr was not using numbers a lot. The Ravens of the past have used a lot of numbers under certain coordinators, and Rex Ryan not only used numbers, but also used a lot of variation in terms of deceptive schemes, such as zone blitzes and stunting and whatnot that he would really like. Martindale, most similar to Rex in terms of that. But you really see the imprint of Dean Pease on Zach Orr's pass rush moves since he's jumped into the booth.
That's interesting, because I haven't studied them pre-Dean Pease versus post-Dean Pease. And we see Dean Pease out on the field, and Zach Orr is, you know, he's helped me with everything kind of thing. He's very vague about how he's helping him. But it's not surprising in the sense that Pease certainly has ways he's done it for a long time, and Orr is probably very receptive, and especially when Pease got here and things were very broken. But that's, I hadn't noticed it as closely, but I'm not surprised.
You were in Cincinnati for the game, probably, when they won there. That was the 41-38 game, or 44, whatever it was, the 3-point win there. in overtime. That game, late in regulation, I believe, they showed the box, and Dean Pease was incredibly animated with whatever he's telling about Orr. He's trying to get a point across to him, and he's gesticulating all over the place. And I don't know if you saw it on TV after the fact.
I did not.
Yeah, so the announcer, I forget if it was Charles Davis or whoever it might have been, said, you know, this is Dean Pease. He's obviously telling him we got to get in there and got to get pressure on the quarterback here. And it's so funny. If Dean Pease is telling you, you need to get pressure on the quarterback. Dean Pease was very passive.
Yeah,
it's true. That was funny.
That is funny.
All right. Got a little bit to talk about deceptive elements here, because normally if you have really low numbers, you might make up for it with deception. They only used four off-ball blitzes the whole game. 0.19 per play is very low. And they only got 3 net yards on those plays. So you figure, you know, a 9-yard pass, a 6-yard sack, and 2 incompletes. Maybe I want some more of that, you know, in terms of but they didn't really up the percentage of off-ball blitzes. Now, that's not a 5+. That means they brought somebody from somewhere they didn't expect. Mm-hmm. They didn't give it away, and they dropped somebody from the line of scrimmage. So it's a what a lot of people would call a zone blitz. 2 stunts the whole games, both incomplete passes. Again, you know, give me a little bit more of that. You know, and I understand the stunts, they usually want to reduce. When you have a quarterback, you want a funnel rush. You don't want to also, Hurts is not a tall guy, so you're really reducing his ability to see over the lineman if you maintain a wall against him. You don't open passing lanes.
No, that's a good one. I didn't know. I haven't gone back to look at it again. But I think it's true. I think that was the plan with Hurts. I think they definitely wanted to kind of keep him contained and stay in front of him. Exactly, like you say. And so that might have been a factor there.
Yeah. I thought we saw that a little bit with Russell Wilson as well, that they didn't really want to compromise the color he was seeing in front of him. And, you know, always put those passing lanes at risk. Even if you're, I guess, if you give a quarterback like Russell Wilson, who's had a lot of passes knocked down lifetime, a chance where he sees some arms and some color in front of him, he's going to be less likely to try and thread the needle the way a quarterback who throws from multiple arm angles like a Mahomes or a Jackson would to try and get it past a hands-up defender. But it's something interesting to watch always with various quarterbacks. And Russell Wilson, I'm not saying he's never been a multiple arm angles kind of guy, but he's mostly been to try and elevate the football, particularly on the deep outside throws.
Yeah, and that makes a big difference against those guys, being able to just vision. I mean, it just comes out to straight vision some of the times. And a guy with Hurts is the same way. If you just keep that wall in front of him. But you're right. And they may have also – it might have been a function of how they felt they could win or not win versus those Eagles offensive linemen if they're going to stunt or whatever. There's a lot of things in play in those decisions.
Right. Matt Ebike did have a big play staying in front of the quarterback. He had a, I think it was drive ending past defense, right? For the.
Yep. I think it was.
And now it's the second play of the game. It's just, it was a first down play, but still led to that drive stalling.
First play of the game was a run by Barkley, right?
And that's right. And second play was first and 10. And it was the PD 92 on that.
Okay.
Play.
Okay.
So, yeah. All right. Simulated pressures. They use 3. And again, all of these elements just look outstandingly successful, but some of it may be the fact that you don't use it as often. Sack minus 6 and 2 incomplete passes. Yeah. Again, you know, what's reducing the amount of this deception you want to do when you're so successful at doing it? Matt Ebike, I'm sorry, 2 plus elements. They had 2 plays. And again, there's some overlap with these other categories, of course, because you had some of these, but a sack minus 6 and a PD 21 at the line of scrimmage, both drive-ending play, so
yeah,
doesn't get much better than that.
No, that's what we talked about. Though there was I thought overall for much of that game they were really good on third down, and that's a big part of playing a team like that.
I guess it'll always come out as a little frustrating to me, and I know there's a like kind of a rule of poker that you can only bluff about a third of the time, or there's much diminishing returns to it, in fact, negative returns. But if if you think of any element of deception as kind of a bluff you're making, if you show it a tendency to do it too often, then they start to, you know, counter plan and whatnot.
Right.
But right now, it looked like everything was pretty much working in terms of deception. Just by the time, I guess, they figured that out, there weren't enough total pass plays left in the game for the Eagles for it to matter as much as it could have.
Yeah, and again, because again, it goes back to what I said before, is that, I mean, if they make the field goals or if they go score touchdowns, then the Eagles probably have to change how they call the game, how they call their plays, and they're probably throwing more. And then, as you mentioned before, now you put the game in Hurts' hand, but they never had to do that because they couldn't score. The Ravens, that is.
Yeah, they were able to put together a very Ravens-esque drive, as I think you mentioned the first time. They ran 10 consecutive times on that last field goal drive they had that ate up, what, 6.5 minutes or 5.5 minutes of clock that they had at that point.
Yep, so, it felt just like we saw with the Ravens so many times.
All right, so Matabike had 3 pressure events, by the way, to lead the team. Humphrey, the only other guy in the entire game with 2+ pressure events for the Ravens. That should say a lot about, you know, what this pass rush was like against Eagles. It wasn't much. All right. Part of the show, we'll move on here. We'll talk some individual player discussion. Bo, you're the guest. Please take us to a player you'd like to talk some more about.
Well, Marlon Humphrey. We talked about, you just mentioned him. You know, on big picture, he's had a really good year. And there's a couple things that stand out. First, we remember talking to him in the fall in training camp, and it was clear that he was not happy with how he played last year. He wasn't happy with his health last year. He felt it was kind of a lost year, and he felt he had a lot to prove this year. So overall, on the fundamental level, he's done that. But what struck me with him in the last month or so, he's been so accountable for how the secondary has played when it's been poor, and again now when it's been good. And as I mentioned in the other show, that talking to him after the game, and he was saying we're just all more accountable. And he, without naming names, he basically said, if you don't want to play ball, you're going to be on the sideline, and if you do, you're going to be on the field, and that's how it's going to be, because that's what the Ravens do. And you could tell his pride was hurt in mid-season when this defense was down there at number 32 ranked pass defense, and there was some embarrassment in that room. And he owned it, and he's been a leader of the group. He owned the fact that they were not playing well, and he's been direct. And like I said, he's really shown accountability. He's expressed it. And so his tone when things are going poorly, and then now that they're going better, has struck me as something that's been kind of a force in that secondary.
You mentioned the fact that he didn't name names. And of course, it's very clear who he's talking about. I'm reminded of a particular episode of The Simpsons. And when I launch into a Simpsons reference, I always have to know, it's going to take me 45 seconds. Is there really a payoff on this? I'll try my best. So it's in the Baseball Superstars episode, you remember them, the Softball Superstar, where they go out and they get all the best all-star players to play on Mr. Burns' softball team. I don't know if you've ever seen it, Bo.
No, anyway, I have not.
Among them, you know, it was back in about the early 90s. So Steve Sachs and Roger Clemens and Don Mattingly run the team. And everybody has some run-in with Mr. Burns about what's going on. And none of them can play in the end except for Daryl Strawberry. And Daryl Strawberry hits 9 home runs, and then Homer pinch hits for him in the bottom of the ninth because Burns pulls him because it's a left-handed pitcher. And he goes, that's what great managers do. Take a lap and hit the showers.
Yeah, yeah.
But here's the funny part about this is they said all the baseball players were great to work with. This is a writer is doing a review of this episode. And they said, but I'm not going to say who, but there was one guy who was a big pain in the ass about his lines and whatnot. I'm not going to say who, but his name rhymes with Manseco.
Yeah. Well, Humphrey didn't get that far. He didn't name names at all. But yeah, when he said, if you're going to play, if you want to play, you'll be on the field. If you don't want to play, you're going to be on the sideline. I mean, that was pretty direct.
Yeah. All pro season for Humphrey, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. He's one of the best corners in the league. They're not even trying to throw at him anymore, really. They threw one pass in front of him for 4 yards in this game. I think that's right. I think it was 4 yards. And, you know, obviously he made an impact as a pass rusher, but he's making an impact because they don't want to throw at him a lot during this game. And my guess from seeing how this game played out, even with only 19 passes, is that they probably in their pregame planning decided that they did not want to go after Humphrey, and they prefer to go after Stevens or try and, you know, throw some slants at the slot corner or whatnot. If that's not Humphrey, actually that would have always been Humphrey if it's a slot corner, but try and throw some slants to Smith potentially on the outside also to get him there. But they really didn't go after him at all. And I think that's the biggest compliment you can have.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let me toss in another player here. Really happy with the play of Malik Harrison. Now, this wasn't the greatest game for Malik in terms of what he did. He moved back to outside linebacker, but something's happened the last 2 weeks where Malik, first of all, last week with Roquan absent, played some outside linebacker and some inside linebacker. And again, I can't tell you how rare that is in today's game. It seems like, well, I can remember guys that played both positions for the Ravens. Well, that has occasionally been true with players like Jarrett Johnson moving to inside linebacker on an as-needed basis, or terrific talents who could cover well from outside linebacker like Bowser or Matt Judon who could do it. There's nobody really in Ravens history who plays outside linebacker and inside linebacker in the same game, differed series to series, even down by down at the beginning of that game. Malik helping them get through this period without Roquan Smith, going to be one of the unsung heroes of this year, at least in terms of what the Ravens have done.
Yeah, and they've talked about him in that way for a couple of years now. Like, well, we love him because he can play inside and he can play outside. And it sounds simple when you just boil it down to a couple words like that, but there's a lot involved, right? And I know when he first got in there in that Chargers game and he was playing in place of Roquan Smith and they gashed him the first couple of plays, and you're like, oh boy, he's look out of place inside. He hasn't played inside in so long, and he's more of a base outside linebacker. But as the game went on, he really progressed. And John Harbaugh said afterwards he thought it was the best game of his career. But you're right, it's not easy to do. And it's valuable on a team like this to be able to put him in both spots. And especially coming, they had to figure out something if Roquan Smith was not going to be able to play. And he was part of the answer, and he did well.
You have another player you want to talk about?
Yeah, I'll mention Ardaeus Washington because, of course, he's kind of in the focus now because so much of this revised secondary, it wouldn't have worked if he didn't play the way he's played. And it's an interesting case with him because here's a guy who didn't get – I mean, his size scared teams off at the time of the draft. He's not a big guy. And the Ravens have always liked the way he's got a nose for the ball. They like that they say he plays bigger than his size, which is something that I always just say about Tavon Young too. Not a big guy, but Ardaeus Washington is not afraid to hit you. Again, they needed him to step in and be able to do what he's done for this whole secondary facelift to work. And they're asking a lot. I mean, you take this guy who's an undrafted guy is now taking over for the guy who's got the number three cap hit on the whole team. And he's an undersized guy, plays with a ton of tenacity. And again, it's this whole secondary makeover doesn't work if he doesn't come in and do what he's done. And I know you mentioned the other show. You're right. If they make this move before the Browns game, then they probably win the Browns game.
It's been a remarkable year. And when I look at it, he probably is one of the most outperforming players, if not the most outperforming player on the team. There's a lot of competition for that. Justice Hill has had a really good year, but we saw some glimmer of that last year. Tylan Wallace has had a wonderful year in terms of what they've asked him to do. But we've seen a little bit of that from other receivers in the past. Ardaeus Washington becoming an every down split field safety was not on my bingo card. And it's something that he's done despite all the possibilities. Every time, basically, he has been shuttled to third or fourth on the depth chart during his career and somehow managed to win the job. He won the slot corner job coming out of camp last year, and they wanted to give it to everybody, including the security guard before him. You know, and then finally, that's who they got left, and he plays great in the preseason, and he plays great for a game and a half in the regular season.
And from the time he came here as an undrafted guy to TCU, I believe it was, every summer He's the guy that's mentioned on the roster bubble. Is he going to make the team? I don't know. He's on the bubble. Do they keep 8 defensive backs? They keep 10. Maybe he makes the team. Maybe he doesn't. And then you're right. Then he's the starting slot corner, plays a couple of games before he gets hurt. Then is he going to make the team again? I don't know. They already got Mallette. They like Hamilton in the slot. They don't need another slot corner. I don't know. Is he going to make the team? And now you're right. Now he's played every snap at safety the last 2 games.
You know what the question is now about Ardarius Washington is, will they extend him early here? Because he's just finishing up year 3, even though it feels like he's been here about 6 years. He's finishing up year 3 because of a lost year of not being on the roster. And so he's a guy who the Ravens really could extend this season. And he actually fits the profile of the typical Ravens extension. It's usually a guy who's not right at the top of the market. A lot of agents don't like their guys signing those deals. And it won't also be a guy who's so questionable that you sign him to simply a special teams 2-year extension with a minimal bonus to the vet minimum. We've seen that with, you know, Anthony Levine and Malik Harrison and others over the last few years, Albert McClellan. But, you know, he's a guy, I think, if he can play safety like this, you got to think about, you know, how about 3 years, $9 million kind of thing, and try and figure it out right after this year. They've got another year of him on the as a restricted free agent. That I'm sure they'll tender him, but I think this is a place where they could sign him early and get real value out of it.
Yeah, you're right though. That's a good point, and it's definitely, he fits the profile of that kind of guy they'd like to do it with.
Chuck Clark was in a similar position, a little more high profile in Clark's case, but he moved to the back end, took over the green dot, did all those things, and then he signed him to a good contract. And I think. As much as Ravens fans will say, Chuck Clark, you know, I don't like how it ended up. Chuck Clark was the best dime back the Ravens have ever had in 2019.
He's one of the best day 3 draft picks they've had. Yeah. I mean, yeah. So, no, that would be an interesting one. And, you know, Ardarius Washington is an inside guy, spent his life on the roster bubble. It would be interesting to see. I would think he would like the security and all that, but he's earning it. He's really played well.
All right, I guess it's my turn, right, without another player. Loved what Washington did in this game. There's so much. He really wasn't hit for any plays. Took a couple losses in the backfield. Let me pick another player. How about I guess we talked a little bit about Board in the first one. I'm still fascinated by the fact that Board and Simpson are alternating series as opposed to alternating specialties. You know, we had – it's not Board as the coverage guy, which, by the way, in his first tour with the Ravens, he was a guy they wanted on the field on third down for coverage purposes. And they were very deliberate in how they did that and made exchanges. And the Ravens typically with inside linebacker rotations have done that in their history. If you remember Bynes, 2-down thumper replaced on third down. Fort, you know, a guy you wanted more in on passing downs, but more of an every down guy. If you look back to how specialized the roles were for McClain and Ellerby and Dimebacks of back in that era, they've been extremely specialized. This really does look like you used the word open competition in the first episode. And I think that's really what we're seeing right now is that one of these two guys may actually win the job.
Well, that's generally, you mentioned it too, and that's generally on a series by series basis. That seems to be the message. They did it. They'll do that in training camp with offensive linemen to try to see, it's part of the competition to see who's going to win the job. Now it's a little different when you're with these linebackers in the sense that I think they're okay shuffling the guys in, but I hadn't even noticed honestly that it was a series by series thing because it seemed like when I looked down or when I took note of it, it was a passing play and Board was on the field. Although I do remember one time he was on the field on a short yardage situation. I found that to be surprising. But again, if it's a competition, it's only because Simpson has allowed it to happen because this was supposed to be Simpson's job. So whatever Simpson is not doing, whether it's coverage or whether it's getting off blocks in the run game or whatever it is, they've made the identification that let's look at Board and let's see if he can do it better. So it's a bit of an indictment for Simpson if this is an open competition, because this was Simpson's job to win when Queen left. But it's, you know, this John Harbaugh always likes to say it's a meritocracy and the best guys play. So we will see if Board ends up being the best guy there.
It'll be a good one. One more player.
Well, Nate Wiggins, how about him? I think Nate Wiggins is one to watch, I think, over the last month of the season because, as we said, fully committing Humphrey to the slot, once you fully commit Hamilton to the back, is going to put Wiggins in big spots. Mm-hmm. And I think he'll be a key guy against the Steelers in a big game, in a big spot. So they're going to deal with Pickens a lot of different ways. But, you know, every year you want that first draft pick. It's always like the sexy pick. Is he going to come in and do what they need him to do? Obviously, it hasn't always happened.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. What's your perfect night? Is it curling up on the couch for a cozy, peaceful night in? Therapy can feel a bit like that. Your comfort place where you replenish your energy. With BetterHelp, get matched with a therapist based on your needs entirely online. It's convenient and suited to your schedule. Find comfort this season with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you're a facilities manager at a university, you know students rely on the cafeteria for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and the occasional late-night snack. So when a dishwasher breaks down and dirty plates pile up, the mess hall can turn messy in the blink of an eye. Enter Grainger. With over a million industrial-grade products and fast delivery, the product you need now is never far away. So you can turn that dishwasher back into a lean, clean washing machine. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
That way, but Wiggins is a guy I think has steadily grown into it. I think early in the year when I watched him, he's still a little bit grabby. But he's a guy that strikes me as being more comfortable and more he looks more comfortable to me, I would say. And I, like I said, I think with this defense shuffling the way it's done, there's going to be more on his plate. There's going to be more pressure on him in big spots. And, you know, first round rookie, that's, you're asking a lot, but you invested in it. And so I think he's a key guy down the stretch for this secondary that I've been saying is so far in this little makeover has really been improved.
Right. He's absolutely critical to this Ravens defense. And to speak to your big spots, base defense is typically played on first down. That's the most common time you're going to be playing base defense. The other team gets a little bit heavy because they want to get a good down and distance situation to go at a second down. When they go big, Humphrey moves to the outside. You move an extra defensive lineman into the game. You lose your slot corner. And so Wiggins isn't on the field for those snaps. Wiggins on the field when it's third and seven. Wiggins on the field in all dime packages. Wiggins on the field, you know, in the pretty much now every nickel package for the Ravens. They haven't quite done that. They had some with White and Stevens on the field in this last game, but almost every one of those Wiggins is on the field. And Wiggins is now getting the second most snaps of any cornerback. And I suspect he will going forward. So it'll be Humphrey, Wiggins, Stevens very close to him, and then Tre'Davious White a little bit lower down. Here's my question for Wiggins for you. The Ravens have not traveled with their cornerbacks, so they haven't chased individual outstanding receivers. And there's a couple different ways you can do that. You can do that by having the number one corner chase the number one receiver, and then you try and handle it that way, either on an island or with help over the top. But I think one of the common ways we see more now in this game is to have your traveling corner be your number two corner and your number one corner go off on an island against the number two receiver, particularly if they're either shoulder cornerbacks, meaning they're comfortable with either sideline and they can find the ball over their left or right shoulder and get the ball that way. So my question with you is this: how would it look if they face the Cincinnati Bengals again at some point, or another team that has a top receiver like Ja'Marr Chase or a good quarterback and receiver combination, to move Wiggins over on the number one receiver, give him help on the over the top in terms of a safety. And Randy Moss, they did that in the AFC wildcard game 1 year, and it really worked out. Having, I think it was Reed over Foxworth was the combination they had doing that. I would just love to see something like that done with Wiggins, where they trust in him even a greater degree. But what do you think about that?
Well, it'd be interesting. You're right. It's not been their MO across multiple coordinators. It's just not something they've generally done. Now I will say, like, I remember the game at Cincinnati last year, Brandon Stevens did a great job. I think it was on Chase. He was physical with him and all that. I think Brandon Stevens he's been a little uneven this year, but I do think they implicitly trust that they're going to line up their guy against your guy and they'll handle it. It's an interesting theory, but with this team specifically, you just don't see it. I thought for a long time, they would happen with Marlon Humphrey when they played the Bengals. And they would have Humphrey shadow Chase everywhere he went. That didn't always happen. So, it's an interesting thought, but I don't think we'll see it, because it doesn't look like something they're comfortable doing.
Right. I mean, I agree. They haven't done it, and that usually means they won't, because they're very much a like clockwork consistency team. There are other things to be said about it that make sense. You're more comfortable with your zone pass offs if you know the guy playing next to you on each and every play, as opposed to that switching around. And so there's other reasons why they might want to keep it the same way, but for whatever reason, it has been the Baltimore way for an awfully long time. That they've got their right corner, they've got their left corner, and you decide the matchup. We're comfortable
right.
with our guys.
Yeah. Across multiple coordinators.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it really goes back all the way to the days of Starks and McAllister. Before that, they didn't really have any cornerbacks to speak of, but to the days of Starks and McAllister, they've really been doing that.
Yeah.
All right. How about we take a few questions here from the mailbag? I got a couple different sources, but I got to bring them up right now. All right, here we go. Going to hashtag film study mailbag if you want to bring that up on Twitter, Bo, and I'll read off a couple of questions here. We got a few things here on Justin Tucker, a few questions. I'm going to try and answer one or two or ask Bo to answer them first. I'll kind of respond. First one is from Randy Morgan, who says, assuming he remains the kicker between the 20 and 40 yard lines, what distance does a fourth down need to be for a field goal attempt to be more valuable than going for it? I'm sure the bots have an answer, but that doesn't account for our historic offense and his struggles. It's a great point, Randy.
It is a good question. I mean, if, you know, a 35, it's really a plus 18 by the time it's 8 back to the spot and 10 for the kick. So 35-yard field goal is going to be a 35-yard spot is going to be 53-yard kick. Fourth and what is worth more than a 53-yard kick?
That's perfect.
I mean, I think that honestly, in past years, Harbaugh would not hesitate to send him out for a 53-yard kick. Now it's fourth and one. I think he might go anyway, because Harbaugh generally likes to go for fourth and one. But if you're suddenly looking at fourth and three versus a 53-yard kick, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what his – some of this, maybe the analytics, some of it's the guts. The bottom line is on 40 and up this year, Justin Tucker's barely over 50%. I think he's 9 for 17, maybe. I don't have him in front of me. But that's just on 40 plus. So, you know, 53, fourth, can you make – you got a better than 50% chance that if you think you can get 2.5 yards, 3 yards on fourth down, it's basically a two-point conversion play. If you think you have your two-point conversion play that you think will work at a higher rate than Tucker making a 53-yard field goal – maybe that's it. Maybe it's 3 yards. Five, probably not. You're probably still putting a Tucker. Okay. It's an interesting one.
I want to give a short preface to this. I was just on the radio last week talking about exactly this topic, because a lot of people are questioning whether or not the fourth and one decision for Harbaugh was a good one from his own 16-yard line. My background's as a mathematician, and one thing I will say uniformly about mathematicians is they think all head coaches are pussies in terms of not going for it enough. And basically anywhere on the field from fourth and one, the general rule is it's always worth it. And there are certain strange game situations where it might not be worth it. But generally speaking, holding onto the football is worth so much that you pretty much always go for it in those situations, or you should always go for it. And Harbaugh has said the same thing. Harbaugh, of course, has a headset elf who talks to him and basically tells him, this is the time you go for it. We're a strong go on this. And he'll still superimpose his own judgment on that and his game flow and whatnot, and decide not to do it some percentage of the time he's told. But I guarantee you, there are zero, and I can think of one his entire career, where he made a truly reckless move that was outside of the normal bounds of going for it. It came on an onside kick in 2011, by the way, weird situation. But the headset elf is always going to be more aggressive than Harbaugh is the point. And he's going to turn down some of those. That's generally been the case of every head coach in recent years in the NFL, even Brandon Staley, who is widely known to be hyper-aggressive. He's a little bit conservative to the average mathematician. My answer on the 35-yard line, by the way, is probably about 4th and 6 or 4th and 7. They ought to go for it. And that would be an absolute slap contest against Tucker to do that, because you're really sending a message there that we really trust our offense a lot more than you. But it's not just that. The payoff is a lot more if you secure that first down. And the Ravens' offense has been terrific at moving the ball inside the red zone. So my answer is significantly more than that. 4th and 7 might be 4th and 9. Would be
appropriate. I mean, that if it's 4th and 9 and you go for it and pass up a 53-yard field goal try, that I think that is really saying something about Tucker. I mean, and maybe that not that it doesn't need to be said, and not that it's not understandable to say it, but that is something that would be. And again, it you can always argue like a Chiefs game, we're not going to beat them with field goals. And I understand some of that argument, but that would be one where that would really be something. I think 53. Now you get under the 40, 42-yard field goal try. It's a fascinating question.
Okay. All right. Really appreciate that. Thanks, Randy, for that one. We had several other Tucker questions. Here's a good one from Alec Poulianos. He says, Isaac was special teams only this week. Mild confirmation he was active over Ajabo specifically for that reason. So I think that's just a comment. I don't think that's inaccurate, by the way, Alec. I think that Ajabo is the guy they probably trust a little bit more in pass rush, and Isaac was the guy they wanted for special teams. Any thoughts to add to that, Bo?
No, but I mean, we see Isaac does play on teams, and this team is going to put guys on the field if they play teams. We see the one little bit of practice we're allowed to watch is special teams, and so kick team cover, you know, punt cover, whatever, and we will see Isaac on those plays, and Ajabo is not part of that. I can't think of a time he's ever been part of it. And so Isaac in a situation like that, if the choice is one of those active and not active, and Isaac's going to be the guy on every special teams play or 14 special teams kickoffs, kick return, whatever, versus Ajabo 6-7 pass snaps, they're going to go with the special teams guy. But yeah, I can't think of the time I've been at training camp and in practice, I can hardly ever remember Ajabo taking part in special teams for whatever reason, whether they've made judgments that he's not capable of doing or not strong at it. But Isaac is a guy that, you know, his season's been disrupted by the injury dating to spring. But yeah, he's out there on teams all the time. So that would recommend him for that would explain why he's out there.
This is a common problem for outside linebackers who don't have the exact body type that the special teams coordinators really want. They don't tend to be fast enough. Now there's exceptions. Tyus Bowser, for example, was certainly a special teams guy, and Matthew Judon was early in his career. But a guy who became a good pass rusher for the Ravens was Paul Kruger. And one of the reasons he had a lot of trouble getting on the field initially was that he wasn't a special teams player. So oftentimes this is a mountain that marginal, I'll say, pass rush specialists need to overcome is, can they either play special teams or can they be good enough as a pass rusher to make it so that they're worth having on the roster on game day anyway? And it's often a tough exacta for those guys.
Yeah. And John Harbaugh is going to historically skew toward guys who contribute on special teams. He sees there's a lot of important snaps, maybe more so than some coaches view it as. In fact, today he was just talking about Marcus Williams being inactive, and he said, yeah, he doesn't play special teams. and Bo Braid does, and Sanusi Kane does. And so they're going to be active over him because ultimately we need those guys on special teams. Marcus Williams doesn't play special teams, so it becomes a numbers game. He's not playing safety, and he's not on special teams. The other guys do. They play special teams. They're going to be on the field.
First of all, it's a great reason to not have Marcus Williams on the field if you're going to play him for one snap of safety or activate him for one snap of safety. That's not going to be worth it. But why can't Marcus Williams play special teams at this point in his career? It's not like he hasn't ever. He probably did as a rookie, in his time there. There is a dark, dark possibility for the Ravens to collect on their insurance policy and get cap refunded to them if Williams is hurt. And that could be a reason why Marcus, I think, would be very, very much opposed to playing special teams because he has to carry that problem into next year. The Ravens get a refund, actually, if he's hurt and misses time. So weird situation. You probably know about that, I'm guessing, with the refunds from player component of the cap.
Well, and we watch them. We're allowed to watch 15 minutes, 20 minutes of practice. And the only thing really ever happens is special teams and then individuals. And so you can see who comes out there and takes part in special teams. Marcus Williams is usually among the guys who comes out a little bit later and is off to the side and not involved. And has never been involved here. I probably did earlier. Screw all these guys play special teams at one point or another. But again, when you're trying to make the guys who are going to play that week, they're going to – a guy like Bo Braid, who's on – I don't know how many snaps it was, but he's on the special teams units. Those are the guys that play.
Yep. Understood. All right, got another one here. This one comes from r/Ravens, so out there on Reddit. Says on the Eagles, and this is Dark Speed 9, on the Eagles' last offensive drive in which they kicked a field goal – Harbaugh used two timeouts before the final 5 minutes of the fourth quarter after stopping them on first and second down, if I recall correctly. I believe Harbaugh did this so that if we stopped them on the next third down, we would get the ball back and could take advantage of the change in clock stoppages in the final 5 minutes. However, this would have meant going into the final four-ish minutes with only a single timeout. Was this the right call in terms of game clock management, or would holding the timeouts for use only after third down be the better option, i.e. getting the ball back with just over 2 minutes and two timeouts versus 4 minutes and one timeout? I think your answer is actually in your question there, Dark Speed, at least the way I think of it. If the opponent is using clock time correctly, I think once you're down to 4 minutes left, the Ravens basically need every second of that clock. So anything that retains the maximum amount of time on the clock is going to be the maximum value for a timeout. So I once you're down under 5 minutes, then they don't even have the reset of the ball on the out of bounds play, stopping the clock and then restarting it again. They don't even have that. So you're already at a point, I believe, where that would be the case. What do you think about, Bo?
I think coaches historically wait too long to start using their timeouts. I have no issue with him using his timeouts early. They saved one, and a lot of teams will try to save one, gives them a little bit of control if there's a late game situation in there and they need, but I see these teams, you watch the clock bleed down to 2 minutes. They got all three timeouts. They don't know when they're getting the ball back or what. I have no issue with it. I think it's smart for coaches to start using in a game situation like that. I think it makes all the sense in the world to use the timeouts early. You can always use, if you get the ball back, there's ways you can control stopping the clock, whether it's throwing to the sideline, whether it's taking a spike, if down and distance allow for it. But I'm of the opinion that coaches a lot of times wait too long to start calling those timeouts. And Harbaugh, I had no problem with it.
Yeah, no problem either here. And you know what? The other sport where what you've just espoused philosophically has changed is pulling the goaltender early in hockey has gotten earlier and earlier as time has moved on. And it used to be they be pulled in the last minute and 20, minute and 10 kind of thing. Now it's like 3 minutes. If you're down two goals, they might do it at 6.5 minutes. That still might be too late, by the way. That still might be too late to start, but at least analytics has had an impact on that in terms.
It's a good analogy. You know, it's a good analogy, but I think it, and Harbaugh's generally been one to do that. He's usually, I know people will rip him for his clock management, but I never have a problem with him starting to use timeouts at 4:20, whatever. It's to me, it makes sense.
Right. All right, let's move on to another one. This one comes from Kid Rock 20. He says, is it just me or does Stout really struggle? I don't know where to get advanced metrics, but it seems we routinely lose field position battle against good teams, and I think punting is a huge component. I do have some things to say about this, but I want to let you go first on that.
So, I think it's really struggle. I don't know. There's sometimes he just absolutely sends some boomers, and then it's just not, it's not always there. I know in the Eagles game, the net was something like 8 yards better for the Eagles than for the Ravens. That's a big difference, actually. Yep. And, you know, part of that is you can argue the errors with the punt returning group for the Ravens and Wallace, you know, letting a ball bounce and roll and all that. But Stout had one really low line drive kick in that game. And I guess the consistency hasn't been there like people would hope. I forget how it was worded, your question, but that sounded a little bit harsh to me. I think he's had some good games and some good moments, but I think Stout would also say it's not consistent. And like the one he had one last night, I think the yardage number ended up being okay, but it looked like a line drive baseball shot off his foot. I don't know what happened on that one. And he was fortunate they got a good roll and ended up being a decent number because it was not a good kick at all. And Shanks, I know he's had
the right sideline, right? From yep. As he kicked it, it was towards the right. Yep.
And he's got, you know, he has had a couple really, I'm trying to think of a specific game now, just a bad time for a bad kick. He's had that happen a few times. And I think those stand out to people as well.
So you hit on the big net thing. Two things I want to hit on. One is for Stout in general, his role, I would weight it as follows. I'd weight it about 45% of his job is being an effective holder for Justin Tucker. It's much more of an impact on the game than just about anything else he can do, even as a punter. Maybe even a little bit more than that. And obviously, he has those are his basic two roles are holder and punter. So 50-50, 55-45 the other way, any of those I could buy into. That's what keeps Sam Cook great and on this roster for so long. Sam Cook had a lot of little directional things he would do and become more crafty as he got older, but he didn't have the big leg that today's punters coming out of school have. And he was mostly there because he was a Hall of Fame holder. And that's one component of that. The other thing is a higher level thing, which you alluded to in terms of the net yards differential, is the Ravens lost a ton of hidden yards in this game. And most of that was lost on the two missed field goals where you then start the drive from that point. The Eagles didn't score on either of those drives, but they kept the field position advantage all the way through that quarter. And the Ravens out-yarded the Eagles something like 201 to 87 in the second half. It was about that. I've got the actual number in my article if you take a look for it there. And they still got outscored 10-7 in the second half. It was a matter of they lost so many hidden yards on special teams, primarily on those two missed kicks.
Yeah, the two missed kicks. And like I said, and the Eagles had much better field position the whole game. And part of it was the Tylan Wallace's punt return issues. And I talked to Tylan Wallace after the game and, you know, he felt bad for how things played out, but I think he's right on the sense that you have to give Mann, I believe is the punter for the Eagles. You have to give him credit because he angled a couple of those punts in such a way that Tylan Wallace now has to make a really tough decision, whether he wants to try to make this catch on the run. He probably should have, but it's not a particularly easy catch coming on the run on the side like that. Mm-hmm. And he opted not to on the one, and then it bounces and the Eagles down it at the 1 yard line. And then they don't get out. That was the series where Jackson has throws into the dirt on third down and then they have to punt and the Eagles get great field position. So the Eagles had good field position so much of that game. And you mentioned the missed field goals and that's what 16 free yards or whatever, just on the spot changeover. Plus the punt mishandles that back the Ravens up. So the long fields are a problem and handing the Eagles good possessions are a problem. And you mentioned the holding and we've kind of laughed when Jerry Rosberg said it years ago. We were out there one day and he said he thought Sam Cook was the best holder in the history of football.
He's probably right.
And it's not something you really ever think about, but Rosberg has done this forever. And I mean, I know that there's a camp that puts Tucker's struggles on Jordan Stout and says, look, when Sam Cook was here, they didn't have this problem. Sam Cook's the great holder and this and that. It's a different time. Tucker is older. There's things changed. And again, Sam Cook is on the staff. And if the holding by Jordan Stout was a systemic problem, there's no one that would see it more quickly than Sam Cook. So there's other issues going on, I think, with this kicking thing. But to Stout's punting specifically, I just think it's a matter of it hasn't been real consistent. And it seems like he's always picked a bad spot for one of his bad kicks.
It's interesting because Stout in college was a remarkable in 10 and in 20 punter. Had just remarkable numbers in that. I've seen none of the same control of the football from him at the NFL level. We've seen booming kicks. We've seen those. We've seen, in particular, the last 4 or 5 weeks, we've seen several punts of 65-plus yards on the fly. Some of them have been returned for less than that net. But it's we haven't seen any of the, yeah, I can put it on the 3-yard line, I can leave it there kind of thing, like we did with Cook and the way he would rotate the football and sometimes get exactly the bounce, you know, magician's bounce on the thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. That has been true. And we see, again, that's one of the little bit of practice we're allowed to watch. And, it, you know, it's not for not trying and not for not working on it, seeing sometimes it's there. But, you know, the NFL kick punters are now in such that if you see a ball kind of fly into the end zone, that's just a bad miss for an NFL punter now. And Stout hasn't had a lot of those, but he's had some. And I did think early, especially Tucker Stout's first year, that was noticeable how much more touch Cook had from the say 15 and in than Stout did. And Stout kind of owned that too and said he felt big pressure coming into this organization off you know, following Cook. But I think it's gotten better. But you're right, it's a good point. It hasn't been what it was in college for him.
I can't even imagine what it was like for Stout to try and learn how to hold, having a camera strapped on him in that first camp and having Tucker, Stout, and Randy Brown all basically ready to advise him after every single hold.
Yep.
We have something in actuarial work, we refer to over the shoulder work as when usually an actuarial student is at the computer working on the inputs for a model. And, you know, we're some sort of financial projection we'll be working on. And you have one actuary is bad over the shoulder because they say, okay, go down there to withdrawals, put in this. I want to see this for mortality. I want to see this for interest. And you know, you'll go through and you'll be like telling them what to type almost. And then sometimes we'd have two people over the shoulder and that is hell for the person who's at the keyboard.
I'm sure.
And he had three.
Yeah, he did. That's true. That first year he had three. Yep.
All right. Got one more question here. Then we're going to call it here. This is an interesting one because he's referring to Aaron Schatz. And actually the Ravens, I think we said this in the first episode, are the best 8-5 DVOA team since 1979, the number one ever. And just to look at this, they're about 3 percentage points ahead of 2012 Seattle, 1992 Philly, by the way, a team that's thought of as having one of the great defenses of all time. They're 3.5 percentage points ahead of them, who are the third best. So they're really comfortably ahead as the best 8-5 DVOA team of all time. Ryan Patrick Jones says, relative to that, he's seen another site, NFL.com, has the Ravens at 97% chance to make the playoffs. But the Colts schedule is very light. Doesn't 97% seem generous? It seems like a consensus conclusion, this team can't miss the playoffs. Whether you want to strap a percentage on this or not now, how unlikely or in maybe qualitative terms do you think it is that this Ravens team misses the playoffs?
I don't think it's likely they miss the playoffs. I think with 10 wins, they make the playoffs and they still have the Giants and the Browns. And that if they win those two games, they have 10 wins. And I know the Colts do have a fairly easy schedule coming up, but I've seen, you know, I just said if they beat the Colts and the Browns. I think the Colts I was looking at the 4 games they have left. I don't have the order in front of me now. They're all winnable, but that doesn't mean they're going to win them. And I suspect they won't win them all. I think the Ravens are in the playoffs if they get to 10 wins. If they beat the Giants and the Browns, they're at 10 wins. Maybe they win one of the other games. Maybe they beat the Steelers. But if they don't beat both the Giants and the Browns, But then, like Parcells says, you are what you are. This is what your record is. And maybe they're not a playoff team. And they're not, if they're not good enough to beat the Browns once, and they're not good enough to beat a 2-10 Giants team, then they're not a playoff team, perhaps. But I think they'll win at least 10, and I think 10 wins makes the playoffs.
Right. I would say I think they are more likely by a factor of probably 5 to win the division than they are to miss the playoffs right now.
I don't know if I go five, but I agree. They're definitely, I would think they're more likely to win the division than miss the playoffs. Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, good, a good chance for that. And we'll look forward to that. There are some nightmare scenarios, by the way. If you see the Colts winning out, some of the real true nightmares come to rest, including Kansas City being able to tank that final game against Denver and get Denver into the playoffs instead of the Ravens. And it might be even them facing us in Kansas, or that would face them or Denver in Kansas City. They might really want to see Denver.
there definitely could be nightmare scenarios. Like I said, I don't see any way. We talked in the earlier show. I don't see any way the Ravens are going into that last game of the season being able to rest anyone. I mean, I just think they're going to be playing for their playoff lives right up to the end. And they've made this bed. They have themselves to blame for that. But nightmare scenarios would be interesting. And their conference record, the losses within the conference won't help, but I think they're a playoff team. Ultimately, I think it wouldn't surprise me if they end up going back up to Pittsburgh for a playoff game, which will also be interesting.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going through the order of where you don't want to play that first game, my number one city, I have no interest in the Ravens going to the playoffs, is Buffalo right now. It's not just because the Bills are great. It's because the crap weather there and how that'll impact the Ravens offense negatively, I believe.
Well, remember, they went up there and it wasn't blizzard, but it was really, really windy the day. And that's when Jackson threw the pick 6 100 yards, and they couldn't get anything going offensively in that game.
There you go. Would your first choice be going to Houston then, I'm guessing?
That would be bad. Yeah, that would be fine. Pittsburgh, you know, yes, Houston would probably be the one. But again, none of them will be easy. I think this Houston game on Christmas is going to be an interesting one, because I can't figure that team out yet either. I don't know what they are exactly. And so I mentioned the Giants and the Browns. Maybe they're going to Houston win that game. I mean, on Christmas. But, I think if you give me those playoff choices, yeah, Houston would be the one.
All right. Fair enough. Bo, a pleasure talking football with you. Please tell folks where they can find your work online and where they can contact you directly if they want to.
Yes. My work is at PressBox. That's PressBoxOnline.com. Got usually game stories, reports from practice, daily, this bye week, maybe every couple days. And then the print issue of the magazine that's out on the streets and stuff once a month. So you can find me at PressBox and PressBox Online on Twitter /X at BSMOLKA, with my other mainly Ravens news and notes.
All right. You become an Orioles writer during Orioles season?
Not so much, although the Orioles have always been my first love team. I've always loved baseball. I grew up in Washington, D.C. Couldn't get Redskins tickets because it was impossible. We came to some Colts games, but then there was no baseball team in Washington. So we were Oriole. I've been an Orioles fan since I was little. So I've always been a big Oriole fan, but I'm more of a fan. I go a partial season playing. We go to 10 or 15 games a year. I've done a couple fill-in things covering the Orioles, but I'm almost always there as a fan.
Okay. All right. Me too. Of course, I love the Orioles too. What year was your first as an Orioles fan?
Probably I came up through my dad to a couple of games in probably the early 70s, I would think. 71, 72, 73 is when I first started to remember going to games.
We're similar vintage. 71 was my first games, and I really just fell in love with it immediately. I had the advantage of growing up only a mile from the ballpark, so we really it was a good spot to be. Anyway, those days were great when Baltimore had a couple of great teams, and we're actually back in a really good position now, and happy to see it.
I have two of the old Memorial Stadium seats on my front porch.
Oh, now that's cool. That is really cool.
Yep, I went down there, got them right before they got rid of them.
That's definitely a nice memento to have. I know they really sold a fair amount of those, and it was a good plan to do that because a lot of people wanted them.
Yeah.
Other folks out there, if you want to do something nice for the show, please just introduce it to somebody new. That older person that's Bo or my age, teach them how to just play it directly off the browser because they're not probably familiar with podcasts or use those a lot on their phone. But anyway, you can also play it off YouTube directly and show them how to do that too, because they may not know. But anyway, really appreciate you listening. Bo, thanks again for coming on.
All right, you bet, Ken. Thanks.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app.
Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
If you're a facilities manager at a university, you know students rely on the cafeteria for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and the occasional late night snack. So when a dishwasher breaks down and dirty plates pile up, the mess hall can turn messy in the blink of an eye. Enter Grainger. With over a million industrial-grade products and fast delivery, the product you need now is never far away. So you can turn that dishwasher back into a lean, clean washing machine. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.